Thanks for tuning in. Just a quick note before we get started. This show is not intended as medical or legal advice. While we do our best to research, the views expressed by the host and guests are opinions and should not be taken as fact. Our goal is to inspire hope by sharing the personal stories of autism pioneers who make exceptional contributions to the autism community.
Did you ever wonder if all families living with autism are pioneers, forging a unique and sometimes challenging journey into each simple everyday of life? Join Erica Daniels, mother of a teenager living with autism, as she explores conversations with those pioneering the unpredictable work, lives, and journeys of people making a difference for families meeting the everyday challenge of living with autism.
Welcome to Hope Grows the Podcast. Today, our guest, Aaron Paul Orsini, is affectionately known as the Autistic Psychedelic. He is pioneering research, creating community, and training folks in the facilitation of a new and exciting therapy for some of the uncomfortable symptoms associated with neurodiversity, psychedelics. Aaron is the co-founder of AutisticPsychedelic.com. The world's first online co-learning community dedicated to the intersection of psychedelics and neurodivergence. The Autistic Psychedelic Community offers peer-supported psychedelic integration for those navigating autism, ADHD, and other neurological variation. Aaron is also the author of Autism on Acid. We used to think of psychedelics as hippie drugs, with dancing bears and never-ending bad trips. We remember the famous Woodstock warning about the brown acid being bad. Like most of the war on drugs propaganda, psychedelics have gained a bad connotation for years. However, in recent years, they are getting a lot more positive talk, with shows like How to Change Your Mind on Netflix and a whole new medical and pharmaceutical industry devoted to research and education surrounding psychedelics. I've been told that psychedelics are the new cannabis as those things go. So today, I want to welcome Aaron. Thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to have you. In my mind, you are the definition of an autism pioneer, and the way that you've forged this journey that you're on and that you're sharing that information with members of the community is truly inspirational. And I'd just like to start by asking you to share a bit about who you are personally. How was your life up until you discovered psychedelics? What made you choose this path? And, you know, where are you today? Your journey, if you will.
Well, yeah. And thank you so much for the introduction and for having me here. And happy to go into some of my story. The easiest starting point is just like kind of going through adolescence, teenage years. I didn't struggle with school so much. I was actually like hyperlexic as a kid. So I had like advanced reading and writing growing up. But I still had a lot of kind of classic autism presentations. And those didn't really become problematic until I was finally diagnosed at 23. I just kind of struggled once the structures of like school and work got a little bit more, I don't know, like less structured. I think I struggled kind of navigating some of like the social intelligences that I might have needed in order to kind of navigate workplace, you know, social context, things like this. So I fell into quite a depression. I was kind of suicidal, very anxious, started using psychedelics really initially as kind of like as like a last ditch effort. I was kind of trying to escape my circumstances a bit, but they brought me deeply into contact with like what those circumstances were, helped me kind of parse out some information that I was previously having a lot of difficulty even accessing, let alone kind of processing. So this was many years ago that it all started, maybe like eight or so years ago that I first started using psychedelics, which feels like forever ago. Probably used them in different doses hundreds of times over the last 8 years for, you know, microdosing, threshold dosing for kind of exploring interpersonal relationships, things like this, and taking larger doses in the same way that a lot of people might for, you know, trauma healing or for, you know, consciousness exploration, things like this. Then I decided to write a book about how these things benefited me because I couldn't find much literature about it. And then people started to write me back saying that they had similar kind of experiences. We formed a community group, and now we're providing peer support and education. We're doing research with University College London. I went from this being kind of like an interesting thing that happened into now this being like my life's work. My focus of all of my work really gets poured into the intersection of autism and psychedelic medicines, most specifically like LSD, psilocybin, and MDMA primarily are the ones that we're educating people on. And bearing in mind also that all three of those are still Schedule One substances in the US and abroad. So we're educating people on things that are legal in certain contexts and soon to be legal in the US in certain other contexts. So it's quite an acrobatic thing to be educating people about something that's fundamentally not allowed, and yet at the same point is very effective for these individuals. So I kind of sit in the middle of all of that advocacy, policy, all sorts of stuff.
I wanted to ask, so how did your family or friends initially react when you shared, or if you did share with them? You know, I don't know what you've shared. I'm assuming since you're so open and public about it, how did they react and how did that go?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this, as I said, this whole thing started maybe 8 years ago. For the first year or two or three, maybe, I didn't really tell anyone that I was experimenting with some of these things, mostly because I lacked a vocabulary for articulating what was even taking place. You know, there's the one layer of it where being an autistic person, I had certain kind of processing that seemed to suddenly be available. And that was challenging a bit to navigate just because it was new. But so also was at the time I was taking a lot more kind of like higher dose, like journey kind of sessions, more like visionary kind of levels of dosing. And because of that, that left me with a little bit of like mental homework as far as like making sense of some of those experiences, being able to like properly integrate them and talk about them. Really what it came down to is like, I had to lead a quality of life that was obviously improved in such a way that when that curiosity came about, like, hey, Aaron sure is doing better. He sure wasn't doing well for all those years. What's different? And psychedelics played a huge part in that. They didn't like replace having to build, you know, a more functional, harmonious, economically viable, sheltered, well-fed, well-slept life that I've had to build in the meantime, but it kind of helped me to kind of like escape the hurricane for long enough to kind of get a glance at where I was at. And then as far as talking to family, I just had to kind of be in a good spot. You know, like if someone's doing well and they say, hey, this is working for me, it might be better received versus like, you know, if I was still struggling with a lot of things. So just by living well, I think that was what eased it. And then obviously like some of the more recent media coverage and all of that normalized it. I mean, I produced all these books basically like for my parents' education so that they could kind of understand that like this was rooted in science, that this was, you know, that these stories that I was sharing were being shared by other people. I feel like it's like one giant like TED talk to my parents explaining like how this all works.
So how did, were they shocked at first? I mean, was it?
I mean, yeah. They're,
how did that go? Tell me about that conversation.
I mean, they're parents. So they were like, no, don't do that. Like,
right.
There's a lot of dangers that prohibition creates. There's a lack of resources as far as being able to test for purity, potency, whether or not.
But they didn't even know as all that stuff. They were just thinking, well, we heard psychedelics or drugs and that can't be good for you. Was it more of that kind of conversation or they were worried?
You know, I went into it with the matter of fact knowledge that, and this whole project, it all stands upon the very solid foundation that everything that I'm doing carries an incredible potential consequence, a risk. I certainly couldn't apply for a select number of jobs that might Google me and find this to be a problematic kind of thing. So in making such a kind of firm decision, like, okay, I'm going to stand on this side of this line now for the rest of my life, that's counterbalanced by how certain it felt the importance of stepping across that line. And it's continued to be rewarded in terms of the number of people who thank me for crossing that line who couldn't. There's plenty of people that couldn't have endured some of the challenges that came about as a result of this. Even in this more tolerant and accepting climate, people just don't know. They have like a very cartoon version of what they think psychedelics might do or be like. And their only real points of comparison are things like caffeine or I don't know, alcohol or something, like something that takes you to a slower or faster state. And these are completely different it's like you're having a complete rearrangement of the perspective from which you're looking out from. And there's no real framework to kind of give people a sense of why that might be important. Because ultimately the reason why it's important is because like that framework is made out of like your own biographical stuff. And so you can't explain someone's like kind of internal mythology. They have to kind of realize that, like intuitively encounter that. And then the more you speak in these abstractions, the further away you get from connecting, like, what does this have to do with, what does this have to do with mental health? What does this have to do with like personal wellness? There's a lot of like dots to connect, and it goes beyond just like, you don't feel well, take this, you feel better. It's a lot more laborious than that.
I wanted to ask you that. So were there different pharmaceuticals or other things that you tried? You shared a little bit about your struggle and, you know, how that led you to psychedelics, but, you know, had you tried different medications, and do you find that you still need other treatments, or is this kind of the way you treat a lot of the things that were holding you back or giving you challenges?
Yeah. So in the past I had tried, you know, SSRIs or a lot of talk therapy. The difficulty for me was that I was spending all this time in a sort of mental space of like mental analytical problem solving, like kind of trying to figure out the proof for like, why didn't this action plus that action equal like a happy, content life? Like
stuck in your head. I know that feeling. Yeah.
Trying to, and what I learned through some of the psychedelic work was that in the relaxation of the part of the mind that's trying to like crunch those numbers and try to like rationally reach towards contentment by kind of powering down that software program, you suddenly find yourself in like a place of, if not contentment, at least perspective, from which you're not trying to find that experience in like a future moment, but you're experiencing it like readily right then and there. And I think psychedelics engender a certain kind of comfort, and, you know, they've shown it at least with like MDMA and stuff. There's stuff that's showing like polyvagal theory being like legitimized by like, basically like your body enters into a space in which it feels safe. And from that safe space, it can make different kinds of decisions, realizations, or even different. They found like differential response to like touch, like affective touch, other stuff that's being impacted just by your, you know, your fear center being lowered down, at least with like MDMA, like fear center being lowered down, enhanced like narrative exploration reach as far as like inner self. And so again, it's really abstract. People are using these tools within our community just as variedly as they would in any general human population. You know, there's people microdosing for their sort of ADHD kind of symptoms. There's people, they're taking higher dose, you know, ayahuasca ceremonies just to have some sort of like spiritual kind of experience that they're seeking.
Right.
So there's no one size fits all. It's just that when you look at autism specifically, and a lot of the things that it appears that serotonin is like modulating, when you take substances like LSD or psilocybin, chemically, they look very, very similar to serotonin. And even LSD has a higher binding affinity than serotonin itself. So any of these processes that are being regulated by that neurotransmitter, we're basically giving like dietary supplement versions of that.
Right. You said microdosing. So a lot of people don't know what that means. Are you taking psychedelics daily? Do you use it as your, I mean, for lack of a better word, medicine on a daily basis? How is it showing up for you on the regular basis? What is kind of your routine with it?
Yeah. I mean, so definitely not a daily medicine. It's never really been researched as such. It's it's not clear whether or not there's like a metabolic buildup for something like LSD specifically. It's like it enters, crosses the blood brain barrier and pretty much just activates at the receptor site. So it's like, you know, it's just being directly passed through the cortex. Anyway, not to go too far down that rabbit hole, but basically not utilizing these substances in like a day-to-day, more so using them as like tools in specific contexts, really. You know, sometimes I'll have to be at a conference and speak for many days at a time to people. Something like LSD or psilocybin will kind of give me more of like an endurance and an energy and an ability to kind of process that layer of interaction really well during that period. But these drugs build tolerance quite quickly. There is no, so far as we're aware, with
they do. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why there's typically in microdosing regimens, they have what's called washout periods. It's just like your body gets acclimated. They've validated it through like dose finding studies. But basically, like if you took, you know, X amount of, you know, psilocybin today, tomorrow to have that same subjective rating, you'd have to like increase that dose on and on and on and on. So it's like, it's unsustainable in that regard. And it's also not necessary. So far as they've shown, sometimes they'll see certain things like changes in sleep patterns that happen like 2 days after a dose or other kinds of like circadian related changes. So you're getting these sort of like generalized benefits that happen like throughout the cycle of how these drugs kind of cascade down further. So that's generalized. I'm speaking just about psilocybin and LSD. I mean, again, there's really authoritative resources on these things now. There's like full books about protocols, things like this. But for our group, you know, and for the purposes of simplicity, like we're utilizing these tools as needed. Some people have their like kind of annual check-in with like more of like a immersive session, some more like reflection.
Can you explain that for people who might not be familiar when you say microdose versus submersive? You know, what are the different kinds of dosing that you're talking about? Can you talk about that a little more?
Sure. So, well, psilocybin's the soonest to be.
Well, actually, before you go there, I want to stop. So can you explain to us, you know, maybe the main or the three or four different types of psychedelics that we're talking about? You know, you've mentioned psilocybin, you've mentioned LSD, but maybe just explain to us what those are, what the differences are, and then a little more about the dosing.
Sure. So psilocybin is the active ingredient found in various mushroom strains. They also make it synthesized. So it's going to be accessible like in Oregon, for example, this year. You'll be able to get like supervised sessions in Oregon with psilocybin.
So people who eat mushrooms, like so to speak, in the most basic sense of it.
Yeah.
Magic mushrooms, or what we might have used to refer to it as more of a medicinal use, or, you know, it's the scientific name is psilocybin, right?
Yeah. That's the active ingredient, which breaks down the psilocin, which is thought to like be the sort of psychoactive component. Okay. And same for something like LSD. It also begins as a fungus, like it's grows as ergot, and then it gets synthesized in a process. But LSD and psilocybin, both chemically at the end of it all, they're like serotonergic agonists. They're partial agonists. I won't go too far down like the pharmacology side of it, but basically
LSD has also been called acid, correct?
Yeah, it's lysergic acid diethylamide. Yeah. So both of those drugs chemically, pharmacologically, very similar. The main difference, you know, they did a comparison study. The main difference is just the time that the drug will remain active. Like LSD, it's like 6 to 8 hours that it's like in the acute drug window. And for something like psilocybin, it's like 3 to 5. So that's the primary difference. There's a couple other different like dopaminergic targets that LSD has versus the other, but they're fundamentally similar in how they present, the different kinds of research that supports them as being enhancements to certain kinds of social cognition, effective like empathy scores, things that have to do with kind of accessing somatic information. Those two as tryptamines, they tend to be the most often like kind of referenced in psychedelics. MDMA has less like visionary properties, can only be utilized once every so often just because of the toxicity profile for it. Like it's, you're not supposed to use it for microdosing or any sort of regular usage, just like every so often for therapeutic purpose as like an adjunct. Very different pharmacologically from LSD and psilocybin, but that might be legal for PTSD patients as of like 2024 in the US. They might approve MDMA therapy for that. It, like the phase 3B trials just got released. So they're just waiting on the FDA's approval. But at the core of all these drugs is the ability for them to introduce people to different perspectives, reintroduce themselves to themselves in some sense, kind of getting a bit of like a walk around. It's almost like the mind takes an individual on like a sort of tutorial on like, here's how you see what you see, and here's how you kind of come to form beliefs, and here's how your pattern guesses its patterns, and here's how that might impact your life. And so by having access to realizing like how the mind is kind of producing the material that you're consuming as your reality, as your belief structure, as all these things, it gives you the opportunity to, it's a bit like watching a movie and knowing you're watching a movie. It gives you a bit of an ability to kind of like not be quite so spooked while you kind of acclimate to the environment. You're like, oh, okay, this is a movie. So that means this is what, okay, that
safe feeling you were talking about.
Yeah. And the same goes with as you get, like, as you kind of just sit and stare and observe life going by, observe your own thoughts going by, the strength doesn't become necessarily that you're like healed of some ailment. It's more so that you tap into a place where like ailment is a part of a cycle on the way towards achievement, on the way towards ailment. And like, once you can kind of lock into those rhythms and kind of occupy a more like further out perspective, the sort of short-sighted, you know, intensity of your moment just kind of gets gentled. And I think for a lot of autistic people, because of our sensory hypersensitivities or the way that some certain situations feel overwhelming, that just having that be the normal mode, having it always be that these individuals are kind of like drowning in their own experience, to have like a second where they can kind of stand outside of like the drowning pool for a second and just kind of observe it and be like, whoa, that can, can be really beneficial. Even if you return to that pool and you just kind of give yourself the signal to like not have to like paddle so hard, you can just kind of like be with it. There's a lot of different ways in which just kind of having that little bit of degree of perspective on your own kind of mental process can really, it can allow you to gentle yourself with your own relationships with others. And for me, it had like a genuine enhancement to my cognition. Like there were certain things I could have never seen or put together if like my brain wasn't making like certain kinds of new patterns, any more than someone that might say, you know, I tried on eyeglasses and I could read more letters on the wall. It's like, it's so, it's a very, you know, eyeglasses adjust that like astigmatism based on, you know, some adjustment. If these same kinds of chemical changes are adjusting, you know, the way that like connections are being forged and the way that like, you know, oxygen and blood flow is circulating throughout the different processing regions, like it's having an impact, and it's having an impact that's measurable within the drug window. We've seen it in general population studies too. Like all these subtle enhancements kind of come and go. Certain of the learnings can remain, but if I drink a cup of coffee every day for 100 days, I'm not going to leave that 100 days being like a more energetic person. I'm just a person that was drinking coffee.
And that you need coffee probably after that, you become sort of addicted to the caffeine. I thought it was really interesting what you said about, you know, you're getting back to yourself. I had my first psychedelic experience maybe about a year and a half ago. I came out sort of feeling like myself again, you know, the buildup of all the external input over the years, you know, kind of drowns out that inner authentic self of who we are. And then we start sort of perseverating and thinking over and over and analyzing everything. And I remember sort of like, you know, there was before psychedelics and then after psychedelics, you know, I felt I had this new connection with myself, and also the things you're saying about safety and that fear. You know, we have all these fears, those are linked to our anxieties, and that feeling of safety kind of stayed with me, you know, after that experience. Like, okay. And also, you know, the feeling of we're not just here, that there's more out there, that there's a greater purpose. And I think a lot of people, whether we think about it daily or not, that, you know, we fear death, we fear all of those kind of greater things. And by having that psychedelic experience, I was able to feel a lot more comfort in that there's more out there. And what we're doing this time is really probably just this time, you know, and it's going to add to anything we do in the future. So I don't know if you had a similar experience or people within your network have similar experiences to that. But I think some people often even have a connection to sort of like, I guess, dying, you know, or like a near death type experience, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who's ever, you know, assisted during any sort of session work, you know, I've assisted many people, sat beside many people as they underwent a lot of these experiences. And it's very similar if you've ever seen like the way a chaplain operates, like in a hospice kind of context. You know, your whole job is just to maximize someone's comfort while they go through something potentially really challenging. And like by supplying that person with, you know, like love and presence and support, that's adding to the effect of the session unto itself, like just by kind of having someone be exposed to kindness, of just like a totally kind of radical kindness, is medicinal as well. Cause like,
so you're talking about set and setting,
yeah,
which are words that the general population isn't always familiar with. They've maybe heard of psychedelics, but you're getting into set and setting, which is really important. So I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, it's really just, you know, the mentality that the individual is bringing and that everyone is co-bringing into a space. I think when we start to talk about psychedelics and we talk about them in frameworks that we're acclimated to, we have to, by necessity, kind of become comfortable with like ambiguous frontier kind of territory. And there's lots of different cultures that have tried to make maps of these kinds of, you know, jumps off into the deep end with some of it. But there's something to be said about, you know, these things are kind of being pushed through the medical model and showing, you know, these people are getting better with this condition or that condition, these different things. But really, I think underneath all of that is just the perspective. It's gaining perspectives, gaining new perspectives that you can apply, and like zooming far enough out that like things that are, you know, an individual carries like self-blame or self-shame or whatever it is, if they can zoom far enough out, they can kind of understand how that like guilt or shame or fear is a driver of another kind of benefit for them. Like, it's just, we're usually looking too short of distance. And when you look at set and setting, it's the same thing. It's like,
so what is set and setting?
I mean, it's just mindset and then the setting.
So it's not like, location. It's mindset.
Yeah. Mindset and then setting being like the location, which can also include like, you know, the lighting, the sound, the, you know, the, who is present there, what's like the energy of the space, because we lack the measuring sticks for some of it, but people who go into these experiences consistently kind of report that there's a lot more of an exchange happening than maybe meets the eye in like a sober state. So when you're in these like especially highly sensitive spaces, if you go into like a high dose session with psilocybin or LSD, you want to make sure that everything in that environment is kind of like energetically, I won't even label it as like a good quality or not, but like something that's going to kind of like, essentially everything's going to kind of harmonize with itself. So if someone who's like showing up to that session, like full of love and like they're present with someone, like they can co-create a lot of just like goodness out of just simply contemplating goodness in those experiences, which again, doesn't make a ton of rational sense,
right?
Because these are, you know, beneficial experiences that aren't coming from the rational mind. They're being received at more of like an intuitive level. And so by giving individuals, specifically like autistic individuals whose processing might kind of be, maybe they just stopped picking up the signal because there was just so many signals that come in for a certain kind of sensitivity profile. But with these substances, there seems to be a new opportunity to kind of try things out in the sort of sensory worlds, like for the first time. It's almost like you enter like new mind once again, and like all these conditioned fear responses, all these other things, those can kind of become background, and you're just kind of engaged in the immediacy of the experience, which again, there's so many people that are like, you know, if I could just check off these 10 boxes, that would make me a happy life. And then they get all those boxes checked and they get there, they're still not experiencing that thing they're seeking. And it's like hidden just behind the moment that they're in.
What is it, do you think they're seeking? What are most people? I mean,
I think in general, I switch it up as far as like what lens I'm living through. More recently, I'm using the framework of looking at life through a reductionist outlook of safety, and that everything is just like a basic metric that compares safety. Like, I love this person so much because that person provides a lot of safety, or like that everything kind of boils down to safety.
You want to feel safe.
It's like a fundamental, you know, it's like the hierarchy of needs. It's all this stuff. And so if you're in fight or flight, if you're not processing stuff, that's just like, you know, being pushed aside for, you know, I'll get to that when I'm not in fight or flight. But if you're like living in fight or flight, you just have this long, like emotional to-do list that hasn't really been dealt with. And so by taking drugs that will bring you into that space of comfort, and again, even like higher doses with LSD too. I mean, with MDMA, it's releasing also a flood of oxytocin, which is for trust and bonding. It's released during breastfeeding, childbirth. So that trust and bonding flood is being self-directed. It can be directed at other relationships that you're processing in that moment. And when the body feels safe, it can make a lot of really like clean and helpful realizations that, you know, it's the same. It's like, you know, build a small block tower in a hailstorm. It's quite challenging, like put a roof over that and then build a block. It's quite easy. So this is kind of just, again, like getting people out of the rain, bringing them into a container, like an energetic container with the other people that are, you know, supporting their intention in that moment with like the sound, the smells, whatever it may be, creating that and really like elevating that person's concept of what's, you know, really possible, or what kind of level of like kind of direct and immediate like joy or, you know, just pure experience can they really access?
Yeah.
And then I think that's the fundamental shift for people, is that they go from seeking towards a relief from, you know, like a sort of mysterious pain to, you know, ideally in like a trauma-informed recovery cycle, you become aware of the root of the trauma, and then you seek to not re-root it again through the repeating of that pattern.
Right.
And simultaneously, you have to arrive to some place where, you know, for people that are in trauma-informed care, they're basically, again, going back to like the safety thing, is like they can't find a calm enough moment to process the trauma, so they remain in the in-between.
Right.
But if you find that safe space, process that, and then understand what it takes to create that safe space again, even without substances involved.
Right. If you can get there, you know, by maybe using the assistance of psychedelics, you can maybe understand how to get there the rest of the time too.
Trulieve believes in providing leading information backed by experts, as well as a model for compassionate care, the foundation of the medical marijuana mission, and are committed to educating not only patients and the public, but also physicians. Trulieve partners with qualified physicians across all of our states to supply education, resources, and industry insight to empower the patient base. Through these partnerships, we are moving the industry forward and ensuring patients have access to high quality, safe, and reliable medicine.
So set and setting. So that could be different for different people. And if you're using psychedelics medicinally, you're typically going through a facilitator. It could be in a medical practice. It could be in a retreat type setting. It could be, you know, at home. People use different things. They definitely use music. They definitely use things like eye masks, you know, where you can go inward as opposed to maybe having a more outward visual experience. The other word that we hear, there's set, there's setting, and then integration. So my understanding is that integration is the therapy of it all, so to speak. And that may come with someone who's trained as a facilitator and an integration that can help you through that, or that something that I suppose you could work on your own. Can you tell us a little bit more about integration? And I know that your community trains people and helps folks with that. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that part of it too.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I mean, integration is oftentimes referred to as like what happens after the session. It's also like a process that begins before it, continues well after it. It's really just, it's the equivalent of, let's say you have a session and you have a very deep intuitive insight that you should, I don't know, talk to your family members more often or something. You decide you want more time with your family. And that's like a very vague intention, but like a way to kind of integrate that is to give yourself like an actualizable like action plan of some sort. Like, I'm going to write a letter to a family member every Sunday or whatever it is. I'm going to call X person like X times a month, whatever. But by applying those insights and like living those insights, when you're having psychedelic sessions, you can get a lot of mileage out of a single session because you're moving at the speed of your own imagination. But then real life doesn't always, you know, you can't as quickly as you can imagine a brand new life, you can't always build it quite so. So you have to kind of be gentle with, you know, having a potential new target for what life might look like. And it doesn't have to be achievement based. It might be like, these are the habits I'd like to weave into my everyday. Like if I could do these five things every day, my life is great. You know, there's so many different approaches you can adopt after the fact, but yeah, integration is just that, you know, during a session, oftentimes newer novel insights will come up, or you'll think of something that seems really obvious, but like somehow or another, your mind has hidden that really obvious thing for a long time because maybe it causes pain to realize that you could be taking action on something, but you're not. Maybe taking that action would send you on some path that some past trauma said, don't go that way because it might lead to this thing. So your mind just sort of gets more options presented. And then in that context, when you're faced with, okay, these are all these options, here's how I relate them to my personal narrative, to my social narrative. And then you ultimately have to go and live life. You can still check in with these medicines, but most of the time, the sort of game we're all playing is spent like not in psychedelic states. It's spent playing the game of, you know, your day-to-day life. And so it's bringing those lessons, and it could be anything. It's like, oh, I learned that silence is a really good practice for me. My way of integrating that is I spend 30 minutes quiet after I get home from work every day or something, you know, like these things until you basically, you're kind of harvesting these insights that you have during an experience and then kind of re-sprinkling them in your life again so that you're like, oh, I reconnected with this thing that I really have a basic enjoyment of, or I reconnected with this memory of this person. I'm going to connect with this person again. Certain things just become what used to be maybe unimaginable because maybe our mind limits how much we're allowing ourselves to dream certain kinds of dreams. They might disappoint us. They might cause anything. There's a number of reasons why our minds kind of get in their own way. And it's oftentimes it's protective. A lot of the times it's like, again, it's like, don't go down that way. It might hurt. And sometimes that can mean like, don't try to fall in love again because your heartbreak happened, you know? So it's overcoming, you know, the learned fear and stepping into kind of like almost like a faith-based step into kind of understanding how the world kind of operates. And similarly, from having these perspectives, I look at it as like almost like I'm occupying like an old model car, like my body itself, my brain, and coming into an awareness of like its own limitations. It's like weird. My, like, if you look at really basic stuff like optical illusions and how little it takes to like throw your perception.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. I like that.
But your mind is always kind of making those best guesses all the time. And so by kind of becoming aware of that being a normative part, you kind of become aware of like, even a very sharp mind can only become aware insofar as it becomes aware of like what it can't become aware of. Like there's certain kinds
good
of
point. Thoughts. Yeah, that's a good point.
So it's helpful.
Almost like a clearing. I noticed too, it's like almost like a reset, like a clearing, like of all the junk that's in there. Is that common? Do people say that?
Yeah. And again, I think it's just, we're so like infantile with how we're beginning with all of this. It's just, I think it was like less than 15% of the US had said they had used a hallucinogenic substance in their lifetime. And then like the remainder, like the majority hadn't used one or knew anyone who had. And like the valley between those two kind of perspectives is quite wide. And I think that eventually, as you know people that went to Oregon and didn't break any laws and got access to the stuff, whatever it may be, once it's about as common as someone, you know, recalling like, you know, I went to a bar and I had two beers, this is what happened. They're like, oh yeah, I've done that. I had two beers one time. And they're like, okay, cool. Right. It's like things right now, it's like this like great, like what's behind this black box? What's inside of it?
Right.
And when you look at more conventional indigenous usages, people are just using these routinely at key points in life change over like adolescence into adulthood, adulthood into parenthood. So if these medicines and these perspectives are kind of always woven into their lives, then like, you know, they don't necessarily see it as like, I'm going to heal my depression. They're like communing with like this intelligence over and over in order to like be more preventative, to like live in a kind of this more harmonious way.
Form of self-care too.
Yeah, no different than if you were to practice meditation, a lot of the same kind of brain imaging outputs have been shown in like deep meditators' minds as this being very similar to brain patterning as those who are like under the influence of psilocybin or LSD. So, you know, there's obvious benefits to like a disciplined meditation practice that are going to come about. There's also time costs that are involved in such things. So it's a balance, but it's really just that. It's not, you know, I try to downplay the narrative of like miraculous change. It's just, you know, it's if you got the opportunity to travel to another country and you got the perspective on your home country, that's quite a high value. If you tried to explain your experience to someone else, they'd be like, well, I don't really need that kind of experience. I kind of already have that like frame of I already have that frame of reference from this other kind of experience that I've had. So yeah, I mean, for some people it's yoga, psychedelics, meditation, breath work. There's so many ways that people are, you know, cold therapies. There's all these different things that people are doing to like kind of vault themselves into a different point of awareness. And psychedelics are just one more tool for that.
Yeah. I think, you know, when people have an autism diagnosis or they're neurodiverse, oftentimes a lot of different ideas or different therapeutics come into play, or they've tried a lot of different things. So getting back to autism specifically, I know that there is currently some research going on specific to psychedelics or certain psychedelics in autism. And I know that you've been integral in making that happen and participating in some of that. Can you share with us what's in the works in terms of autism specifically and psychedelics
research? Sure. So up till now, there was a handful of studies in the pre-prohibition era with like LSD and psilocybin with autistics. Those studies would not hold up to the same standards of today. They were like administered in like youth and adolescence in like circumstances that just wouldn't go through ethics today. But there is incremental movement in the same way that cannabis went through incremental movement towards understanding like safety and tolerability for younger age groups. There's been up till now, with the exception of in the near future, there's going to be ketamine and MDMA therapy trials that are going to be run in adolescent age. The MDMA is going to be targeting like war survivors, like teenagers who are like PTSD war survivors. And, you know, they've already done safety panel information for a lot of these things. It's just, you know, there's a lot of hurdles to tiptoeing towards like working with younger minds, things like this. There's a development where a group is trying to use psilocybin to address Fragile X syndrome, which is like the leading monogenic cause of autism. It's only in animal models right now. So like they basically take these rats that they give some in vitro medicine to that sort of emulates a Fragile X sort of presentation. And then they give them psilocybin and measured all these different ways that they interact with other rats. So that's many years away from being kind of pushed into any sort of like human clinical trial context. There's a study that's happening this year in London where they're going to give autistic individuals psilocybin, do brain imaging studies, and give them social challenges. I think that study specifically will show a great deal, not only in terms of like, I'm anticipating we would see increases in the performance on the social cognition task, and also that the differential response would be much greater in the autistic group than it might be in the control group. They did a similar study with just giving them one SSRI dose, and the autistic group improved on the social cognition task. So as they're zeroing in on this sort of like serotonin kind of anchored theory around, you know, some of this, which is also so complicated, like autism weaves in like gut biome and GI stuff. There's a million theories as to what the underpinnings are, but a lot of those theories have intersections with these medicines. So yeah, as far as, you know, we did our survey with University College London also, like I was a co-author on that. And
tell me about that.
We got the data back. It's in peer review. It should be out early next year. It'll probably be published open access, like Journal of Pharmacology. Basically, we got a couple hundred data points from people that participated in the survey. The general results were just that these autistic individuals were benefiting from psychedelics in the same way that non-autistic individuals might self-report, you know, as far as depression, anxiety, things like this. One of the most marked changes, one of the most consistently reported changes, was the autistic individuals reported like an increase in having an interest in being around other people, enjoyment of being around other people. And that's such a core thing, more than like addressing being autistic and all these other challenges. like our core ailment is that we're disconnected, and disconnection creates isolation, creates poor mental health, creates oxytocin deficiencies, creates poor opportunities for academic success, workplace success, general health support. Like, without being able to meaningfully connect to others, we struggle mentally, physically, everything. So the thinking goes that psychedelics might catalyze some of that social learning, or kind of make what's otherwise only able to be kind of taught intellectually to us can become a little bit more intuitive and therefore more useful. Because when you look at like applied behavior analysis, it's a lot of like memorizing things to do, but it's not the same window that one might take if they were going through like kind of like a sensory informed approach, where they're kind of, rather than trying to get a desired behavioral outcome, you're trying to actually get at like, what is the cue for this individual's like nervous system that is making them act in this way? And is there a way that we can support that response and redirect it and still get like some productive output from the whole situation without the individual having to like dissociate from their like genuine response to a situation? So how can we be like supportive of those sensory needs rather than having them like endure the sensory challenge, if we can kind of like orient it, which is sometimes a high demand. Certain individuals' sensory systems are just so not calibrated to a lot of the environments they might find themselves in. Even like a moderately busy small classroom might be overwhelming for some of these individuals.
Right. That's why I wonder, you know, if psychedelics, what the effect on people who have sensory processing challenges already, would that be even more overwhelming to them in some cases, or does that tend to sort of regulate them? I know sometimes in cannabis, you know, we say like THC sometimes makes people with sensory overload kind of brings them back to baseline in sort of an opposite way that a neurotypical person might experience it. What do you think about, you know, people with sensory issues?
Yeah, I mean, I've tried my best to kind of distill down the logic of like dosing and context dependent dosing, and because these drugs perform very differently depending on the amount that's ingested. And so at really, really low amounts, like microdose levels with like LSD or psilocybin, you might, let's say you have a light sensitivity or a sound sensitivity, you might experience like a more, you know, increased intensity of those inputs. And that's where like these tools are so global in terms of how they impact like the foundational kind of processing of the mind and body, that there's just going to be that sort of trade-off. So, you know, when I talk about, you know, the ability for an individual to kind of process some of this more complex mental territory, that's allowed for in exceptionally calm environments where there's low inputs, so right, that they can like dedicate all that internal energy to processing like what they're going through. And that's just where it just takes an experienced like facilitation center to kind of understand the amount of like sensory input that the individual is receiving. Because for, you know, MDMA, psilocybin, and LSD, all of those are going to, you know, enhance one's kind of tactile senses, increase the intensity. And so it's a matter of controlling for that. And then in other contexts, you know, that same sort of enhanced sort of tactile nature can also allow people to kind of somatically process memories and certain kinds of stored traumas or things in a way that's more accessible because they're more kind of like embodied during those same kinds of experiences. It gives like an opportunity to enhance that. But certainly there's, you know, reports, I'm amongst them, you know, if I was to be taking a certain amount of a certain compound, some of the ways in which I'm overwhelmed, say in like a very busy group environment, might be exaggerated further. But all these things are so complicated because you're not just talking about drugs that get people up or down. Like there's a weird paradox wherein I can take something like LSD and be in a large group setting, but because of the way it allows my mind to work, suddenly I'm able to kind of shift focus into smaller kind of subsections of that environment without kind of being overwhelmed. It's difficult to describe. It's like I feel like I get to kind of like commandeer like the mixing board of my mind to be like, okay, play up that level, play down that level, to like there's a bit more of like a control layer to it. again, I think it just comes back to that like safety layer, or like some of these kinds of processes, they might just not become patterns because they're really, you know, convoluted ways of mentally doing something, but they might come about, no, that's interesting. I thought about this problem in this new way, but that might be like a really poor use of energy to always be coming up with like brand new ways of doing all these different things.
Right.
So your mind just remembers, you know, successful patterns does that. So by kind of editing these, iterating on them, it can be, yeah, potentially helpful, but you know, it's going to take a while. Oregon's the very first place where people can get supervised visits. It's going to be a couple $1,000s probably for like a single session.
It's very cost prohibitive right now. It's unfortunate.
As compared to like the price of production, which isn't terribly a lot, like we have the chance to, we could treat this kind of like how like insulin was intended to like kind of just be distributable and accessible. Like it's a very inexpensive, psilocybin specifically is like a fairly inexpensive medicine to produce and produce mm-hmm. safely and like to cultivate. You know, most people in our group, they just cultivate at home. It's technically legal to grow spores and mushrooms for research purposes. It becomes illegal as soon as you ingest one or grow one to a certain size. But all this stuff's like reachable, accessible, and we're just going to have to navigate these next couple of years because it's so much more difficult to abstractly explain this to people than it might be to, you know, give them a medical screener, make sure that they're safe to try something like this. And at a very low dose, they'll have some perspective that will allow them to grow in some way. I think there's a subtler opportunity here because again, indigenous use, there's individuals that are going from being children to being adults, all these different transitionary phases. And it's introduced not to like heal that person, but as a means of just helping that person hold rhythm with like, here's how much you grew here. Here's, you know, it's like a bit like going to a mountaintop at certain points in one's life to kind of look at all the steps one's taken. And that could be helpful. It sounds so obvious when it's explained in that framework, but we have to like walk people backwards from these drugs being associated with some sort of like radioactive something. Like it's much more subtle. It's like, if we can equate them to like a pharmacological equivalent of like a deep meditation, it's basically like you're sending people into a deeply meditative place. And that's about it. They're going to come back with insights. They're going to either integrate them or not.
Yeah.
Still have to keep living. So
I think what is challenging the most to me about psychedelics, I mean, I have a son who's almost 18 who has an autism diagnosis, and he has limited language and ability to communicate his experiences to me, which I find challenging sort of in all ways of trying to help him and make him feel more comfortable in the world. I can best kind of view that by how his mood is and how I'm observing him, so to speak. And so there's an entire portion of the autism community that may have, you know, more of a challenge with communication in terms of the facilitation or interacting with the practitioners that they're working with, or even that may be younger than a lot of the people in your community. So what are your thoughts on, or do you have experience within your community on those other subsets and age groups along the autism spectrum?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, again, just purely from my standing as like sort of an academic researcher in that, like, I mean, the shortest answer is we don't really have the data on it. We just don't have any safety data on how these drugs are tolerated in any of these age brackets. We have anecdotal evidence showing that people are benefiting, self-reported stuff like this, but we don't, for good reason, it's difficult to, you know, it's one thing to get any of these through ethics without the controversies of all these other layers. Like to get a psychedelic study approved by an ethics committee, you're already depending on the institution or the, you know, governmental funding agency, you're already in a tricky situation. So it's like, this is downstream. This is more like, you know, 5-10 years from now, after all these major indications have been looked at, like PTSD and depression, mm-hmm. there's way more depressed people in the world than there are autistic people. There's a lot of depressed autistic people, but there's just a massive amount of people with trauma and depression that like vastly overshadows this particular group. And so I think what you'll probably sooner see is just general population studies looking at ages, like to begin with. And then if that goes all right, and they have like a couple of years follow up and they're like, all right, that went well, and this blah, 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 then maybe they're like, okay, we'll also add this other component of like these individuals are developmental. But that's where these that's where the mechanistic studies come in. Because if they can show like, oh, this drug behaves this way in these mechanisms of the mind, therefore, more than likely, if introduced here or there, because that's the angle that they're taking with the Fragile X stuff and with the other study in London, they're basically just looking at it through this lens of, you know, if serotonin is implicated in some of these key like developmental windows, might it be beneficial for there to be like this serotonin-like analog present in an individual? And if so, what are the outcomes of that? And we have the pre-prohibition data, which was obtained unethically, but was promising. And we have anecdotes from people. We have families in our group that like parents will take mushrooms or other things like it, as like a family group, like they'll have like a group session, like process things like together. And they found it really, you know, beneficial. It's really like, it's an intense thing. You kind of open up to yourself, to your family members about any and all things. It's kind of a, it's a vulnerable place to place oneself into, but it's an opportunity for a lot of healing if handled kind of correctly.
That's why we really need this research, I guess, because until we actually know the mechanisms and can prove that they're effective, it's going to be challenging.
Yeah. And there's just different models. Like in Oregon, you don't need any medical condition whatsoever. You just need to be over 21. So I already have people in Oregon who are like, hey, I have a list of clients. Some of them are autistic, or like using your specific case as like an example. Ultimately, those decisions are going to be like pioneered by people like you or other people, because ultimately doctors won't be in a position to make these decisions for anyone for probably another couple of years. But meanwhile, legal access is already here, like in Oregon.
Yeah.
So it's ultimately going to be like family decisions. Ultimately, the safest of everything is to rely upon like the informed consent of the individual receiving the medicine. The safest thing is to like draw lines there and be like, well, if consent can't be provided, then we ought not provide this medicine. But you're familiar also with like the complexities of medicating a family member is also medicinal for more than that family member. It's creating like a calm enough environment that other people can get rest, or that, you know, other people's energies can be taken into account. So like, you're not just medicating an individual, you're medicating a whole like social group. And so ultimately that decision, I feel, is going to be made by those kind of social clusters, families, for lack of a better term. But
yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think we sort of saw the same thing with cannabis and families, and, you know, people are using that for children as, you know, very young now, as young as three now, or even younger, you know, in cases for seizures and things like that. And so I think that makes a lot of sense that, you know, I've already sort of seen that this is even probably more complex than that.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, I think you're right about that.
Yeah. I mean, there's roadmaps for all this stuff. We figured out how safe it was to give SSRIs or amphetamines to 11-year-olds who are having focusing problems.
Right.
There's protocols in place for like walking up to understanding safety and tolerability and all this stuff. But along the way, and all throughout this process, even beyond the horizon line, when psychedelics become just totally uninteresting, like the internet or something, it's just like, oh, it's just like a thing that's part of our lives now. Move on.
Yeah, right.
But once we get to that point, I mean, there's going to be a whole lot of other kind of consequences of any sort of development in that same direction. Like, I find myself, the further down this kind of tree branch I go with kind of questioning, because the further along this healing journey that I've gotten, the more that I realize that the person that was making me sick along the way was like myself and my willingness to be complicit in certain kinds of agreements I had forged without investigation, and then making different determinations. So like, there already are people that have made these determinations or making decisions from an evidence-based outlook. It's going to take a number of years. It's not to say it couldn't happen quite quickly. Like if any of these studies I mentioned get a indication that like, yes, this is a viable path for these substances to take as far as utility goes, I mean, there will be people that are interested. There's like 100 million autistic people in the world. And I think that when it comes to circumstances, like there's individuals who can't necessarily provide that informed consent, I think that's difficult. I think also working with like any sort of mind-altering experience that an individual can't convey or communicate is going to create another potential challenge or difficulty.
Yeah.
But at the counterbalance to that is that these drugs are being looked at as kind of foundational shifts that would allow for certain kinds of awarenesses to even form. So
yeah,
it's like we're getting so close to like the root of like the issue that it becomes a really difficult thing to kind of wrap our heads around a bit. It's like if we give these individuals this substance, they might have an enhanced ability to like process this kind of information. Does that necessarily equate to like a quality of life improvement? Did we give them like
a new
challenge? Like all of a sudden,
yeah,
like all this
we
other
just
stuff
don't know. Worry, yeah. We
all this
just
other
know.
Stuff to worry about. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, and yeah, kind of wrapping it all for myself. I mean, I've had to balance, you know, a number of years ago when this stuff was really making a huge impact in my life. More recently, my life has kind of become oriented around teaching people about this stuff. And there's been plenty of times where I've become like unwell trying to help a lot of people become well. And that became like a new learning for me, was like learning my own limitations of what was like possible to contribute. But there's a lot of effort. And like the stuff that you guys do with the Hope Grow stuff is the same thing. It's just like giving some sort of counterbalance to like, not even a counterbalance. It's like, they're just a void of information. There's not a lot of good, reliable, like evidence-based info on a lot of things that we could probably know more about if we efforted towards that, if the funding went that way.
Yeah.
Any number of things.
I can relate to that completely, you know, knowing in recent years, you know, I always found that it was really not just beneficial for people that I was helping or families that I were helping, but it was also helpful for me. It was very fulfilling for me. But at some point, I think you're right. Like, you get to a point where you start to become depleted because you're giving so much of yourself, and it's hard to sort of find that balance and continue to do the work. But that's, you know, sort of another lesson in life, learning that balance of what's good for yourself and self-care and being able to continue mission-based work.
Yeah, no, very much so. And it's exciting to talk about these tools because they can be kind of like exponential catalysts, like people becoming interested in looking at their patterns, modifying those same patterns. And by kind of by continuously becoming re-interested in that task as a group of human beings, working on our individual selves, working on like our social well-being, anything that orbits around that kind of intentionality is going to yield something of benefit, like compassion, patience, these basic things that are kind of perennial kinds of things. But it's just to kind of take away the sort of like magic side of it and just realize that my very general outlook on all this stuff is that, like, again, back to that safety thing of like our bodies, our minds want to keep us safe. Sometimes that program runs so hard that like we avoid things that are going to make us well, or we pass on patterns that might actually serve us. And so just by reconsidering those, looking at them and just observing, like, we can make a lot of our lives better. And for certain individuals, autistic individuals, it can be really hard to just take an instruction like that, like observe you have to like kind of learn where your eyes are first before you can kind of like learn how to see. And so that's, I think, the underneath it all, you know, we're not curing this condition, or like we're just providing lenses for people to consider, you know, their limitations and their strengths.
What advice do you have for people that are interested in psychedelics, and, you know, where can they find you? What programs are you currently offering?
Yeah, you can go to our community site. It's autisticpsychedelic.com. There's like podcasts, videos. We have a class now. It's like autisticpsychedelic.com/learn, LEARN. We're educating therapists, facilitators on, you know, history, context, forecasting, you know, future models. I'm training people in Oregon through the Alma Institute. It's like another psilocybin facilitation training program. So I'm training people out there. So if anyone's in Oregon, you could take that training, but their waitlist is already like thousands of people. There's a lot of people that want to become facilitators, that want to seek these services. And there's definitely a shortage. And you can't just create someone overnight that has what is admittedly quite a, you have to have a pretty broad skill set to start to do a lot of this work and have to have gone through quite a lot of like self-work on top of all of that. Right. So there's, you know, we can't just activate, you can't just like give them a clipboard and send them in. It takes a little bit more like, you know, wisdom and learning. So, but ideally we move towards, you know, that being kind of a normalized structure. So that's kind of how we're doing with our class. It's like, whether this person is a doctor or they're taking their friend to the park next week, we want them to have as much information as they can so that they're safe, so that they're, you know, reducing any and all like avoidable risks. And yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
So that's amazing. What we're doing.
Amazing. I want to end with a question that I'm asking all of my guests. We are Hope Grows for Autism. This is Hope Grows the Podcast. Hope has been a constant theme in my life, and I would love if you could share what hope means to you.
Yeah, I think it means like staying on a path, knowing where the path goes, and then just kind of like re-arriving at the place where you know it's going to keep arriving at, I guess. To me, like, hope is a state of not allowing like anticipation or desire to kind of like cloud out the appreciation for like each small step, basically. So yeah, when I look at this journey that I'm on, I don't even know if I'm like hoping. I already kind of know. I feel like I'm just waiting. I'm waiting for a bunch of other people to like take the same walk around that I took. And then they can walk back and be like, oh, that walk around you took, they looked like, I'm like, yep. And they're like, okay. And I'm like, okay. And then that's it. that's not a very succinct summary, but I just feel that
it's fantastic.
So much is abstract, but yeah, I mean, that's what I'm hoping for with this whole project, is that people can step into some really basic perspectives that they didn't know they could have and apply those in a lot of different situations and just lead a generally better quality of life just from having a few insights.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much. It was awesome to have you on today and hear more about your work and what you're doing and your personal experience. It was good to see you.